Main engine start.
I remember the day so clearly.
One liftoff.
Roger, roll, Challenger. Obviously a major malfunction.
I ran outside as fast as I could and I looked up in the sky.
Couldn't believe it. It had exploded.
I'm science reporter Fiona Pepper.
And I'm Dr. Carl.
We're going to tell you the story of Challenger.
Challenger Legacy. Search for Science Friction wherever you get your podcasts.
Or on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
My guest on Conversations today is Umberto Clerici. Umberto is the chief conductor of the Queensland Symphony Orchestra. And both these things, Australia and conducting, are relatively new for Umberto. He's Italian, and his family have lived in the northern city of Turin for many generations. And for most of his musical life, Umberto has been playing the cello rather than conducting an orchestra. It's an instrument he was taught to play as a little boy while sitting on something he calls the chair of torture. Hello, Umberto.
Buongiorno.
Tell me about this chair. What was it? What did it look like?
Oh, so it was a chair full of spikes and it was designed to make you sit still, not to move your head, not to bend it. Also, to have your elbows high enough. The cello, it's like you have to a little bit hug it. Like, and therefore, if the arms are too low, then you can't really play with a proper sound. The thing is that this chair was used when I was six.
Six. So, and literally spikes coming out of it. I mean, it sounds like a medieval torture instrument.
A little bit. Also, you know, this was 35 years ago, so times changed. But my former teacher was actually is a very creative, extremely good teacher and a very creative man, but he was very strict. The funny part, if I can see from outside now that I'm 40, I remember still now, and I was six, his face when he tried this chair with me. I was very vivacious, I would say. So it was difficult to contain me. And so this chair was the perfect tool to contain me. But my mother, because at the Suzuki school, the parents have to be present. And my mother was always present. My mother now is retired, but she was a Supreme Court judge for criminal felonies. So, you know, she was dealing every day with homicides and really bad stuff. And I remember him asking my mother, is it okay? And my mother, that couldn't contain me either, says, absolutely, I want a copy of it to have at home.
She wanted to put you in a chair as well.
Yes.
Umberto, did you ever get pierced by it or did it work? Did it let you bring your energy into the cello?
Well, you know, I think I still remember it was not meant to be a torture, but to be a guide for the rest of your life. So I still have a little bit this instinct that when I lowered my arm when I play the cello, it's, you know, these wirings that we have from our childhood and say, okay, no, you shouldn't do that. Not because it was painful, but because it was the right thing to do.
So your mother was a judge. Yeah. What about the rest of your family? Are there musicians in the Clerici family tree?
Actually, no musician. I only had an aunt that I never met because it was in the early 20th century, so 100 years ago. And she started a great opera singing career. She won one of the biggest competition auditions that there were at the time. But because of the times, when she got married very young, then the husband that was a businessman says, no, I don't think this is the right. I can't. I mean, the paradox probably, I never met them, but he was really seduced by the fact that she was an artist and a singer. And this, until she married her and then say, yes, now you are all for me. So that is the only musicians. All the other members of my family are lawyers or judges. I'm basically surrounded by law, so I have to behave, basically.
How long has this been the case with your family?
Actually, I don't know, but at least four or five generations. So I remember in a basement of my parents' apartment, that is a building 1760, 1770, in the basement, there is a plaque of my grandfather was chief judge. So If I wouldn't have been a musician, probably I would have followed the law.
So what did that mean for the kind of environment in your family? Was it are people quite stern? Is there a sense of punishment if you do the wrong thing? What atmosphere is there to be in a family of such upholders of the law for so many generations?
I think two things. The first one, it was that it was important to have a general culture, so to have a proper education. In Europe, particularly in Italy, we still have a quite old humanistics-based formation. So that was the first thing. The second is, while my mother, despite being a judge, she's a crazy woman in the sense that she's really so flamboyant. And sometimes, you know, when I remember her driving us around and using the horn of the car more often than a French horn in an orchestra, you know, to the point that she would exhaust it. And I was thinking, Mom, you are a Supreme Court judge. You can't do this. My father was always a lawyer, you know, was a lawyer also at home. Everything had to be taught before being said. So she really pushed me and my brother, who is a violinist, to study music. She didn't want necessarily that we became professionals. She thought it was a very good way for a kid to expand their horizons, you know, also socially, a group of kids that have shared the same passion, even when they were young. So this dichotomy between my mother that really was for the arts and my father said, no, absolutely. First you study at university, something else, and then we will see, actually create a little bit of tension. But at the same time, the musician I am now is thanked to this too.
What do other Italians say about people from Turin?
Oh, they say that they are not really Italians. It's a little bit like Melbourne and Sydney, but you have to multiply by 2,000 or 3,000 years. So the roots are so deep that actually the rivalry is really crazy. So is between even cities very close by, Florence and Lucca, or Pisa and Livorno, all in Tuscany. But, you know, Dante would be exiled. So, no, you have to leave the city and would go 40 kilometers away, and there was a hero. And so Italy is really divided north and south in a way, in mentality. And my mother's mother, so my grandmother from my mother's side, was from really the south of Italy, because there was this big exodus for the big Fiat factory. Torino was very, very industrialized. Fiat, Lavazza for the coffee, Olivetti for the technology. So a lot of Southerns migrated between the wars and immediately after the Second World War. And she was the heart of the family, you know, really warm. Basically, I wanted to live with my grandmother. You know, it's the woman of my life in a way. From the north, we tend to be reserved. You know, we like to say that the north of Italy is the most industrialized place in Europe. It's more industrialized even than the south of Germany. It just, we have the baggage of the south of Italy. Unfortunately for us, the south of Italy is what makes Italians Italian. You know what I mean? It's the creativity, the spark, the joy, the smile. And I really like to have this drop of southern...
You mentioned, Umberto, that your mother was involved in your early training as a musician as part of the Suzuki method, where parents have such a crucial role. Was that appealing for her, this high court judge who's also such a flamboyant driver on the streets of Turin? How did she feel about joining you in your music lessons, do you remember?
Well, you know, my mother wanted to be a ballet dancer, and she... When she was young, I would say in the 50s, the only really ballet academy was in La Scala in Milan. That for Australian standards is really close, because Torino and Milan are 130 kilometers apart. But for Italian standards, particularly at the time, was another world. Therefore, she couldn't really join that, because my grandfather was also a judge, saying, no, I think, you know, it's impossible, it's too complicated, also it's not the right path. So my mother always had this desire of artistic expression. And when she saw that the Suzuki school, the Suzuki method, was important in Italy, in Torino, we just went to listen to a concert of the orchestra. And she thought, it's a very good idea. It's true, because you see these 50, 60 kids all between 8 years old and 13, 14, that they are really communicating and enjoying being on stage. And also the Suzuki method is a very nice idea, in the sense that you don't learn an instrument academically, so reading the music and then understanding the technique, but it's like you learn your mother language. So basically it's by imitation. You have to be very young. And so you see your teacher and then at home your parents and you imitate them. Of course, the problem is that my mother never played an instrument. So she had to learn, at least for the first year, a little bit of the instrument in order to make me imitate her at home. And then went south quite quickly that, but then I was convinced. When I was seven, I knew I wanted to be a musician.
Why? What was it that grabbed you?
What I still love on stage, particularly when I play, is, you know, is that moment, somebody calls it the zone, but is that moment in which nobody can really bother you. You have the control of the time, because music is the art of timing. And so there is no email, no phone, but also that is a moment in which time stays still. That I always liked. The second thing I liked is the social aspect. You know, it's a little bit like when you play sport. I played soccer for many years when I was young, but you join a group that has the same interest. We went to music camp that was for weeks and weeks, and we played, and we played both music or games. I remember table tennis, and, you know, we stayed there for a month. It was really a music camp. And so, you know, you have the feeling that you are part of the same community, and so socially, and also when you are good, it makes you, it's like in sport, just the different community.
Was the discipline something that appealed to you, or was that an obstacle?
Well, it's always an obstacle, discipline, but you know, it's the friction between the desire, and this is really an Italian genetic, the desire of breaking every rule, but at the same time having strict rules that, first of all, contains a little bit your instinct, but also makes the breaking of the rule much harder. This is the challenge of as strong as the rule, as better and tasteful is to try to go around them. Not necessarily break them, but to go around them. So just an example. In these music camps, of course, at 10 o'clock or 9:30 in the evening, lights off, with these big rooms, boys one side, girls in the completely other side. Of course, this made it very appealing to try to challenge the system and to get to the girls' room, even if we were 8, 9. So it was absolutely harmless. But it was the point of, you know, it's like to go to rescue the princesses. And because my former teacher was really strict, I remember first thing, 9:30, everybody shuts up. Of course, as soon as you say something to your friend and this, okay, Clerici, come with me, please. Say, oh, no, now, 15 minutes of scales, arpeggios and this. So you stayed in this big room by yourself and he's going around like a sentinel, you know, like a guardian, and you're playing this. Then you go back to the room and your friend says, what did you do? And say, oh, I did scales and arpeggios. Clerici, again, with me. So I just said, no, the rules are rules.
Why was it the cello that became your instrument?
Because at the time at the Suzuki School, you could only choose between a violin and a cello. I was kind of, I wouldn't say chubby, but kind of solid. And so the cello actually looks better. But more than this, basically, there was a demo. So two players, 1 year older than me. I was 5 and a half, so I would say 6, 7. One played the violin and one played the cello. The idea was, okay, we show you what you will be able more or less to do in a year. So you know where is the path, because a string instrument takes so long to learn. You know, a piano too, but at least the sound of the piano is already there. You might miss all the right notes, but at least the sound you can't really destroy.
It doesn't hurt to listen to.
So the cello was a very small cello, almost a viola, actually, with an end pin. And because low frequencies needs more body, it was basically harmless or silent. You know, you could, when you put a mobile on a table and you let it just not ring, but vibrates and does this. This was the sound of the cello. It didn't sound sexy at all, but it didn't sound atrocious. Then the violins come in, and of course it's a miniature violin, and this guy goes for it, really. And so it felt like you put a cat in a washing machine and you put a spin on. And it was, and I was thinking, you know, it's the time in which you also start school, grade 1. And so you have this feeling of the imposition of life, that until then it was the best time of your life. You were at home or a kindy, and basically you were the king of the house. And then, you know, your paradise done. Now the purgatory starts. And so I was thinking, I remember thinking, oh, I already have to go five, actually at the time it was 6 days a week to school now. And I also have to play an instrument that was really not my idea. And I can't bear that violin. You know, it's at least let's play the phone vibrating on the table. It's fine. So that was a little bit the why I chose
very
the cello.
Very unromantic way to getting you to choose the cello. Yeah. Russia and Russian musicians play an important part in your musical story. What was special about the first time you listened to the Russian cellist Rostropovich?
Oh, that's, you know, cellists in a way, historically, they because their repertoire is not as big. In the solo world, the three really instruments that they can do an entire career only solo is the piano, the violin, and the cello. But the repertoire, because actually an instrument is defined by how many pieces and which kind of pieces you can play, the repertoire of the piano is probably 80, 90 times wider than the cello, and the violin is probably 3 or 4 times wider, or maybe 10. Therefore, you have much less pieces to choose from. And in a way, cellists has to be more creative and more open-minded than the others because of this reason. So Pablo Casals, before Rostropovich, was, you know, really fought against Franco, the dictatorship in Spain. He left Spain and really protested for all his life. He was a political figure, was very famous everywhere. Everywhere he was going to play, he would play the Song of the Birds, a Catalan folk song that symbolized freedom. Rostropovich left Russia, like a lot of artists, escaped, went to Washington. He became an ambassador of the resistance in the Cold War. Then when the Berlin Wall fell, he was there playing Bach. So cellist tends to be the ones to be more than their instrument. They want to be ambassador of humanity. And so Rostropovich was this mythical, mythological figure. And I remember he came to play in my city in Torino, and I just won my first small competition. It was 9-10, and let's say the first prize was, I don't know, $600-$700. And the ticket for that concert was like $250. And I remember the feeling of, like, basically an aeroplane. He played like an aeroplane in the sense that the sound was enormous. It's like I couldn't even almost hear the orchestra. And he was his aura, his personality, that was just, it was amazing. And, you know, he was not a charming or a handsome man. He's like a statue. He's like one of the, you know, the David, Michelangelo's David there. But not for the beauty, but for the presence.
And then you spent quite a bit of time in Russia at different points in your playing. Why is that?
Oh, because, first of all, the tradition of Russian strings is incredible. Most of the greatest when I was young, you know, so recordings from the 80s, 90s were from Russian players. Also because Russia always used music and sport as a part of propaganda. So they really, in Russia at the time of the Soviet Union, to be a musician, to be a successful musician, meant to have a much better life than most of the people. Only the politicians and KGB had, of course, all the privileges. But the rest was sportmen that, and you know, if a sportman, your career lasts really short, but a musician can last all your life. So because of this political push, the quality of the players was incredible. And then they have, probably for cello, the biggest competition in the world in Moscow. It's called the Tchaikovsky Competition, starting in the 50s. And it's a sort of Olympics games for music. You need all your life. It's the best players in the world. They go there. It's a tournament of a month. And so I went there and I won a prize. At the end, all these thousands of applications, they get reduced until you have 5 final prize winners. And that opened quite a lot of concerts in Russia. And because I always like to explore, I had the agent, a bit dodgy, but actually it was good. You know, and he says, would you like to go to play in the Far East Russia, because we know Russia basically for Moscow and St. Petersburg, but it's a little bit like Brisbane with the rest of Queensland. It's really close to the European borders, but the rest of Russia is enormous. And so he proposed me a Trans-Siberian trip. So to do, and I was young enough, I was 22, to just say, yes, let's do it. And I loved it. It was so hard to do it, but it was great.
How were you greeted as a musician there by people in that far distant part of the country in Siberia? What did they make of you?
Well, as a musician, it was great because of the Soviet Union system. These Rostropovich or Richter, or the best musicians, would, when they were confined to Russia, would only tour in Russia and constantly all Russia. So these people, that they had small villages, no infrastructures, and for an Italian it was difficult, the food there, you know, because all was...
I can still see your pain, Umberto.
Oh, because, of course, it's a land, very cold land, particularly in Far East, it's always frozen, so... You know, we are used as Mediterranean as tomatoes and mozzarella and, you know, all the Mediterranean vegetables and olive oil. And then basically it's only potato and cabbage and pork fat that I remember is called salo. And it was unedible. I said, no, but with vodka, it's like, with benzene, you can eat anything. But they were very, very highly cultivated. I really remember concerts in front of 500, 600 students, they all played an instrument very well. So actually, musically was a great... And to see this dichotomy, this friction between a simple way of life, at the same time, a quite deep insight into classical arts. And coming, sometimes, you know, I say, well, it's a remote city. I say, who's coming here? I say, well, the last cellist they played here was Rostropovich 10 years ago. You know, I said, oh my God, why do we want to spoil the memory?
What instrument were you playing during your career as a cellist? What was your cello? What was its history?
That's a good question. I didn't buy my own cello until 10 years ago, because the problem is that old instruments sounds better than new ones for several reasons. One is getting old, the instrument loses all the water and the liquids in the wood, so it becomes more mineral, therefore it's more resonant. The second is that playing an instrument, the vibration mold the wood, so the amount of surface that vibrates gets bigger and bigger. So an old instrument, you know, this mythology about Stradivarius and this. The problem is that they are so expensive, these instruments, that it's almost impossible for a young player. So I played very good instruments, but all given by either owners that they had it in their family or banks or foundations that they are Deutsche Bank or the Nippon Foundation. They bought a lot of Stradivarius. It's impossible. No, we're talking some particular Stradivarius over $5, $6, $7 million. It's impossible. And then... until a certain time where 10 years ago I bought an instrument that is not as valuable as Stradivari, but it's valuable enough, and it belonged to the principal cello of the opera in Paris. The maker is called Testore, who made this instrument in 1758 in Milan, and then somehow, sometime, traveled to France. And I don't know the history before him, but between the 50s and the 80s, belonged to him. Then he died, the widow kept it, and when the widow died, the kids said, okay, we don't play the cello, we need to. But if you think how much this instrument, these instruments in general, if they could talk not just music but words, what they saw, you know, they saw the Industrial Revolution, the French Revolution, the both world wars, and the amount of, you know, music and travels and sweat and passion and frustration that got injected. That is what they make so special. For me, it's like a travel time machine, a travel into the past. Also, when we had a strongest relationship with the natural elements of the world, we didn't have computers, we'd have carbon analyzers. So they could cut a tree in the north of Italy, in the Dolomites, actually, a region, a spruce, and they would say, okay, the shape of this instrument will be like this because this wood tells me that. Now we have to, you know, put an X-ray. we lost this touch.
So it feels like your instrument is very human to
you. Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, what I often say is that it's not my cello, but I'm his cellist because I'm his custodian. In Italian, cello is male, so I will always say he sounded and played for 250 years before me, playing him. And then when I will retire, I won't play anymore, and so I will give it. I will sell it is not the right word. I will give it to another custodian. Probably will sound for the next 400 or 500 years. It depends about the global warming. So, you know, I'm just a small part of its or his path and not vice versa.
Umberto, what first brought you from Italy to Australia?
Curiosity and a lot of friends that there were. There was a moment in which friends around me, but generally Europeans, I would say 10 years ago, were really talking about Australia. Having very long roots and very deep roots, it's in a way is also can jinx a little bit you as a young artist because, you know, if you play in Italy, you're famous for Italian opera, Traviata, Bohème, Verdi, Puccini. And so basically you tour, but you always tour with that. And so in a way is a little bit limiting this because, of course, you have a huge expertise, but everybody expects that you always do that. Australia, it has a European heritage, not just as an English country, but it's also there's a lot of Europeans. So has the taste for classical arts, but at the same time is young enough to say, okay, can we try to do this differently?
How long did you plan to stay?
Oh, probably 6 months. And it was because my colleagues were very nice and because I met my wife. And then, of course, after I met my wife, we didn't want to meet anyone at the time, both. Then we met at the opera house, actually. And I was away for a tour, so we wrote each other very old-style relationship for 2 months, actually.
Is she a musician too?
Oh, no. She's, of course, with my family tradition, she couldn't be anything else in the law. So when I met her...
She's a lawyer.
When I met her, she was a lawyer and now she is a judge. So actually she covers both parts of my family.
That's perfect. How different... I mean, maybe the difference was clearer when you first arrived, but what are the differences between Australia and Italy, and how does that come out in the way that orchestras play?
I think Australia and Italy, in a way, are the opposite. Both have very strong plus sides, but I think after now it's almost 10 years I live here, the society works much better in terms of global society because there are rules, everybody understands the rules, not necessarily they understand the reason of the rules, but they understand that is the way to make us all live in the same space. In Italy, it's all based on personal connections. Connections also, you know, therefore, everything is impossible if you don't know the right person, or everything is possible. Therefore, on a small scale, works very well. Because, you know, rules are fine, but shades are so many more than the rules.
So what does that mean for music?
There is a movie that is just 40, 50 minutes long that you can find on YouTube by famous old director Fellini that's called Prove d'Orchestra, Orchestra's Rehearsal. And it's, of course, it's almost a caricatura, but it's not really. It's an extreme version of an Italian Prove d'Orchestra. It's such a mess. You know, everybody has to have a say. People, half of people strikes. And the other people says, no, I don't like this piece. I'm not going to play it. So it's just a mess. And only the moment in which everything is aligned, like Mars and Jupiter, then it's amazing. But the rest, it's just a mess. While in Australia, it's exactly the opposite. So what we, and I'm trying to transfer here, is that in art, we need to be braver, we need to be more adventurous. When we are on stage, we need to transcend a little bit what we are. It doesn't matter if we are shy or sad, or that is the moment in which you have to communicate what you are doing. So if the music is cheerful or cheeky or tragic or sad or, you know, thoughtful, sometimes I feel in Australia we are a little bit shy on express our emotions, and through art you can actually express it. And sometimes it's difficult to find to break that barrier. And of course, because in Europe the tradition is longer, everybody knows how to play a piece. So the first rehearsal, everybody just know. And so if you want to change it, that is the problem, because they are used to play this since 200 years. One of my first experience in orchestra was very young. I was substituting principal cello in La Scala in Milan, one of the probably the most famous opera house in the world. And we were doing Verdi Requiem, and I remember turning to the rest of the section and say, can we just change this bowing? Means you can, you know, with a bow you can down, go up or down. And the back desks said, absolutely, you can't change any bowings. And why? Because these are Verdi's parts. Verdi was conducting this, and this is his parts. There's no point to change. So that is obviously great. At the same time, you are condemned not to do anything different. Well, in Australia, is in a way, it's the opposite. You arrive to the first rehearsal and sometimes it's a little bit white. And then you have to put the ingredients and the sauce on it in order to make it. So it's more malleable. It takes just a little bit longer.
Was conducting always a dream of yours?
Absolutely not. I always, from orchestra players, hate conductors.
Why? What, they're like the teachers?
Yeah, because they are aliens, you know, in the sense that you have somebody with a baton that in theory is in control of the music, but at the end is the only one doesn't produce any music, doesn't produce any sound. So you have 80 people, this guy in front of them giving the back to the audience. So it's clearly not the main actor. Because otherwise, which kind of show has the main character giving the back to the audience? And at the same time, tell them or ask them how it should go without producing any sound. And because music is a oral art and not a visual art. So this is why, tendentially, orchestra musicians think conductor is... It's very important, because when the amount of musicians is too high, it's impossible to be together only visually and to listen all the parts. At the same time, often we think he's an imposter. What do you want?
So how did your first opportunity come about, and why did you say yes?
It started like this. I always had a score, a full score with me in rehearsals in orchestra, because I was always interested, since I was 7, to interact with the others through music. So with the score, you can see things that you not necessarily can hear on a big stage. You know, here we play with the flute, there the horns have the second beat. So if it's a little bit late because of the distance, we have to wait for them. So I was always interested in this interaction. So after many years having the score, my colleague says, are you going to be a conductor, because only usually conductors score? Say, no, I just am interested in understanding how the piece works a little bit more closely, and then I can play. So because of the Suzuki school, I tend to memorize very quickly. I would play in the orchestra most of the symphonies by heart, so I would just look at my colleagues and say, okay, here we play with the horns, here's the timpani. And so my wife, because one day I said, well, maybe one day I will give it a go, just as a curiosity. For a Christmas, I think 5 years ago, my wife gave me the first baton and said, well, in case, when, if you want to try, at least you have a baton. Very nice baton, engraved with a very nice quote from the Don Quixote about music, that there is no evil when music is there. So I had this baton and then started to say, okay, maybe one day I really have to do. And so the Sydney Symphony Orchestra had a concert lined up that was not necessarily a normal classical concert. You know, the opera house gets hired by external promoters. In this case, was an arbitrate world convention. So again, lawyers.
More lawyers.
It's like there's no escape from them. And so because lawyers, they wanted to have a concert at the opera house, but because it was a convention, couldn't be a long concert. But at the same time, they didn't want to have commercial or pop music. They wanted to have, you know, a bit of Dvorak New World, an Australian piece, a little bit of Mendelssohn. And so the orchestra said, it's out of the season, we don't have a conductor here. You know, this is complicated repertoire, because usually for this classical repertoire, you really need a proper conductor, but nobody is available. would you like to try? And say, why would I do that? I say, well, you know, you always had the score, you have this baton, try. And I said, but, you know, I never did it. And say, it is a saying in orchestra that is true. It says, you know, it's better to have a good musician that knows the music, that is a bad conductor in the sense that doesn't really use the baton, instead of having a bad conductor that is also a bad musician. So at least, you know, you can inspire your colleagues, and then if it's a little bit messy, they will complete the dots. And so I took it very seriously and say, okay, I wasn't going to do it. I studied for 6 months at the Con, where I was on tenure as a lecturer at the Conservatorium in Sydney. So it was a colleague of mine, head of conducting, who was many years ago assistant of Leonard Bernstein. And so I went to him and said, listen, it's a bit weird for me. But then it was very good. He really was, he gave me a lot of time. So I arrived to this gig and I really didn't know, because the difference is that you have instincts in your movements, but they are so wired, these instincts in your cello playing, because I played since I was 5. So you have to relearn your instincts by moving in a different way. But the baton helps because it was always the extension of the bow. At the beginning, it was the bow and then it became a baton. So it's a stylization of a bow. So if you're playing a string instrument, it's easier because in a way it imitates the bow. It just goes sometimes up and down while the bow goes left and right. And then after the gig, my colleagues, the same colleagues that usually gives you a very hard time when you get to it, came to me and says, I think you're very talented at this. You should continue. We will support you. And so then it went very quickly, because next year I had 3 projects with regional tours and this. The other orchestra started to think, okay, if Sydney Symphony Orchestra gives a colleague that it always goes bad, this always gives him these chances, probably is good. So they started. And then COVID hit. That was a little bit of a hit, but was also good because a lot of overseas conductors couldn't travel in the country. So when we were open, there were more opportunities. So it was a fast forward button, COVID, for me.
Was it a big leap in your mind that you had to make, Umberto, from being part of this orchestra to stepping up and putting your back to the audience, as you say, and facing your colleagues? Did you have to do a mind flip?
Personality-wise, not. That is why, you know, there's this huge tradition of Italian conductors from always, because we are raised to be a little bit that, you know, to be not ashamed of saying what we think, or not ashamed to actually guide the others and to be fully committed artistically and say, no, I think this is extreme, we have to play extreme. It's part of our culture to be open and decisive and very individualistic. In Italy, if you are not yourself, you are weird. While I find sometimes here, if you are too much yourself, if you are young, then they consider you weird, you know? But because I have this accent, I'm part of a different world.
You're given different freedoms.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. I'm exotic enough, I always say. And also, I can be very strict and cutting with orchestras, but because of the accent, it gets funnier. The concertmaster of Sydney Symphony Orchestra said, you know, if you would say the same thing, it's like, you know, when the orchestra plays without any passion, and I would say, guys, it looks like we are queuing at a post office. You know, so what are we doing? And he said, you know that if you say this with an Australian accent, they will hate you. If it's an, a German accent, they would put you in jail. And with an Italian accent, they all smile.
So what's it feel like when you're there on the stage with that beautiful baton in hand and these 80, 90 musicians in front of you attending to your every move? What's the sensation like?
I feel myself like I'm the router. So I'm the one that provides the internet connection. I'm connecting musicians. And for a conductor, the real job are the rehearsals. The rehearsals is where you connect the musicians, you make them listen to each other, because, you know, music really teach us how to listen. We all able to talk, but how to listen. And that is where what I think a conductor is an enabler of music making through connecting musicians. So when we arrive to the concert, the orchestra should be trained enough to listen that it gives us freedom.
Is the live performance the most rewarding part of it for you?
If the rehearsal is done properly and, you know, sometimes we don't have enough time, yes. Because you can have an excitement or an adrenaline given by two things. The first is just the performing. You are there on stage in front of 1,800 people. And so that gives you a shock of adrenaline. But also the adrenaline should come from the music itself. If we are not prepared enough, the adrenaline comes purely by the performing side. That is not really, I think, the right adrenaline, because it's always this adrenaline come from fear and uncertainty. So they are all highly trained, so they get to the end, you know. And also because we are used to be so precise and the audition process in an orchestra is so crazy that what we think is not perfect, it will never be heard by an audience member. But when we are ready enough and comfortable enough to actually get the music going under inside of us, and so then the energy is through the music. So when it's very nervous, it's between the music, not because you are nervous about playing the music, then the experience is completely different.
What's it like when you come off stage after a performance like that?
Oh, I just need calm. And this is what sometimes is difficult. You know, you did a rehearsal in the morning and then it's an hour or 2 hours performance. And then, of course, patrons and the boards and they all, let's have a function after this. It's great. It's part of the job. But that is the moment in which you would like to be in a silent place for 20 minutes.
Well, what would be happening to you in that if you had that? If you could do that, be somewhere silent for 20 minutes, what would it be?
You just need to decompress, because we can't have silence anymore in our life. We have music everywhere, radio, iPods, our phone basically is a jukebox, and everywhere there is noise and music. It's hard to have lack of it after this overstimulation of a concert like that.
Is it hard to sleep for you after a performance?
Actually, it's hard to sleep despite of the performance, also for my hyperactivity. It's very hard also to wake up then. No, I don't think a performance... it's more when I study. You know, Beethoven had all the sketches, 7 years sketches. So you can see what is his mind process, why he got to the final result, what was his first idea and how did he develop there. So when you stay there and trying to understand, entering in his mind and trying, okay, 7 years of development of this Ode to Joy, you know, and it's a very simple, such a simple tune, but it's simple because he worked on it for so many years. You know, would be different. He would be... You see, there's a combination of scales and fast and short notes. Then, yesterday was there in the first movement. The pacing is very hard. And I stayed until 2 o'clock. And then it was impossible to sleep. And every time I think, oh, why do you stay until 2 o'clock? You know it.
How does your Australian wife cope with this hyperactivity of this Italian maestro that she's married to?
Oh, she's hyperactive too, actually, thank God. But she's also happy that I travel so much. I have problems in finding boundaries because music is it's not a job. Therefore, it's very difficult to unplug it. You know, if you're in the middle of your researching of how a piece should go, what did this person thought? What this person felt? You know, if you think the premiere of Beethoven 9 changed the history of music, Beethoven was there on stage as a second conductor because he was so deaf that he couldn't really conduct. But he was so deaf that when the orchestra finished, he didn't have any idea. He was still in his core trying to understand where they were. And so there were people crying and everybody standing. And this man was still facing the orchestra with his score, didn't have any idea that was finished. So the actual conductor had to tap on his shoulder and turn him and seeing this crowd. And can you imagine the feeling of that? You know, completely silent. And he didn't even know when he finished.
But it's wonderful to meet you and get a little insight into your musician's mind. Thank you so much for being our guest.
Oh, I hope I didn't invent too many words today. And you were amazing. I hope also I didn't talk too much. It's difficult to stop me. Grazie.
Umberto Clerici talking about his work as the chief conductor of the Queensland Symphony Orchestra. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.